Are we in the first stages of the breakup of Britain? The Scottish independence movement launched its campaign for that in a skirl of pipes and fluttering of kilts on Friday. I'll be discussing and arguing over that shortly. And are we in the early stages of the Eurozone breakup? Will Greece finally leave? Will the pressure then switch to Italy and Spain? But for now, the pressure is on Germany's Iron Chancellor, Angela Merkel. Will she buckle? And from hero to zero in 24 hours. That's Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, as the stock market flotation of the decade flounders amid lawsuits and accusations of greed, hype and deception. But Zuckerberg is laughing all the way to the bank with his $19 billion swag from the float. All that and much more to come in the next half hour, because this is The Real Deal. Welcome to The Real Deal on Press TV, still the voice of the voiceless. I'm George Galloway. Every week in central London, I bring you the news and views you just won't get in the corporate media. Shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip. But if you want to fire back at me, at least you could by email at the address showing on the screen. Now, we've been here before many times, but it may be that we're now in the final act of the Greek Eurodrama or melodrama. France and Germany are at loggerheads over what to do. The new French president, François Hollande, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel clashed at the midweek European Union summit. The Franco-German spat is framed in terms of the German-backed austerity measures, which have dominated for the past 2 years, against a new French-led drive for growth policies at a time of record Eurozone unemployment. Vive la France, I say. All of which, of course, plunged the financial markets into turmoil. And it will continue until at least the end of next month, after the Greek elections and a French parliamentary poll on June the 17th. If you're of the betting persuasion, unlike me, then take my tip that a solution will be found to allow Greece to remain in the Eurozone, if only on the grounds that while keeping Greece in will be hugely expensive, it'll be much more expensive letting them go. Now, if you've seen the film The Social Network, you'll have a pretty good take on Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook. He set up the social network site at Harvard University, initially as a comparison site on campus girls. He went through no end of controversy and sharp practice and sharp elbows in establishing Facebook, and he's at the sharp end of it again. After months of hype about the float of the site, which has a billion users worldwide, the appetite for its shares collapsed after the initial launch on Friday week. Shares opened at $38 each, valuing Facebook at gazillions and making Zuckerberg's holding worth almost $20 billion. But the shares are now trading at around $31, valuing the company $4 billion less than it was just a week ago, and earning it a new moniker, Fadebook. And now the law firm, which won a $7 billion settlement for Enron shareholders, is in pursuit of Zuckerberg, his board, and the banks advising the company for making alleged untrue statements about Facebook's financial performance. Surely scope there for a Facebook sequel movie, The Unsocial Network. Egypt went to the polls during the week in its first ever free presidential election. Who becomes president, and indeed what the president's powers will be, won't be known until Tuesday at least. A runoff vote is scheduled for the 16th and 17th of June if no candidate gets more than 50% of the votes. And until there's a new constitution, it's unclear what the president's actual powers will be in any case. But that will be sorted, I'm sure. And the new president will become not just the most important leader in the Arab Middle East, but a powerful figure in the international world of politics. The Scotland Yes campaign launched its campaign on Friday. This is the nationalist movement for the breakup of Britain, otherwise known as Scottish independence, and led by the Scottish National Parties and Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond. You know my position, I'm against it. I'll be campaigning against separation, but I will also be pushing for more powers for the Parliament, economic powers, what they call Devo Max, or even independence light. But I won't be joining what appears to be coalescing or curdling amongst the official opposition to independence, led by the former Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, Alastair Darling. He held a secret summit of Labour, Tories, Liberal Democrats, and passing Uncle Tom Cobleys and all, a call to arms, he called it, and he wants Tony Blair to join it. Blair, knowing a lot about arms and corpses, the hundreds of thousands he helped create in the wars he wrought on Iraq and Afghanistan. And these are just some of the reasons that I won't be joining that blood-soaked posse. But joining me now to talk about Scottish independence as an independent commentator, he's a man with his eye on the future of Scotland and Britain. He's my old friend Torkel Crichton of my own newspaper, The Daily Record, which happens to be, of course, Scotland's leading newspaper. Torkel, thanks for joining us. I'm out of it now, not in Scotland. You're there on the front line, 800 days to go. How does it look to you?
Well, it's going to be a long 800 days, isn't it? Alex Salmond launched his campaign to set my people free, but the big question from the people is, why are we waiting? Why do we have to wait 800 days until 2014? Bannockburn, the anniversary of the robber baron William Wallace's defeat of his English colleagues, because, of course, William, he came from a North London suburb, didn't he? Although he pretended he was Scottish.
And both of them spoke French, of course.
Indeed, Norman French. But how does it look? Well, for all the bluster and sound and fury of the Pipes and Alex Salmond's own skirl, Scotland, Scots are still 2-1 against separation. I know you besmirched Alistair Darling there, the real Iron Chancellor who saved Britain in 2008 and now wants to save Britain from separation. But the first thing Darling did when he got some money to fight this campaign against independence was find out where he stood. And he commissioned an opinion poll, quite a big opinion poll from YouGov. 1,500 Scots were asked whether they wanted to be in the UK or in an independent Scotland. 58% for the UK, 33% for an independent Scotland. 2-1 against. And this is crucial. Crucially, that leaves less or just over 10% undecided. Salmond's own figures show him that there are 20% of Scots undecided. He's going to spend the next 2 years trying to pull them into his camp, but it's going to be a very, very good day that he's going to get that full 20% and a majority for independence. So even looking, barrowing down at these figures that the yes to the UK camp, if you want to call them that, have given us, it turns out that just over half of the people who voted for the SNP in the Scottish elections last year, when they trampled the opposition, just over 57% of the people who were SNP supporters last year would not back independence. So what does that tell us? Does it tell us the SNP were brilliant last year, or just does it just tell us that Labour were absolutely rubbish last year? Let's discuss
it tells us, Torkel, is the answer to your question, why do we have to wait 800 days? Because, of course, if the match was held on Saturday, Alex Salmond would lose it. So he's hoping to spend the next 800 days on something turning up, like Micawber, and him being able to drum up this fake, ludicrous mania around Bannockburn and Robert the Bruce and all of this. And what's his chances of doing so? How foolish are the Scots that in the 21st century they're going to cast a vote on how they will live forevermore based on faux patriotism from 700 years before?
I think they're a lot cannier than that. I know we Scots have a reputation for looking after our pockets. So this YouGov poll also asked people where they thought they'd be better off. 47% thought they'd be better off within the UK. 27% thought they'd be better off in an independent Scotland. So when it comes to the bobbies in your pocket, a clear majority want to stay in the UK. And you explain there quite succinctly why Alex Salmond wants to wait so long. Because if the poll was held next Tuesday, he'd lose it. That's why he wants two questions. And you, George, you're feeding him with that, wanting your Devo Max option. I think we're going to get Devo Max anyway. I think that's pretty much the will of the Scottish people, and more powers will come to the Scottish Parliament. But they'll want to stay in the UK. Alex Salmond sees Devo Max as a stepping stone, because if he can add the one-third he gets for pro-independence and the one-third of people who want more powers, well, then he'll say two-thirds of people back his opinion rather than the paltry 33% who actually do. So that's to play for. But also, I think Alex Salmond wants to wait longer than 800 days. 2014 is not the real date Alex Salmond's looking for. He's got two other dates in mind. The first is 2015, where when he goes to bed every night, he prays for a Tory majority in the UK election in 2015, so that it can then set the Scots against the Tories, who are completely unelectable and unpopular in Scotland. And then his next date is 2016, when he hopes to go for his third term in the Scottish elections as First Minister, without having put that crucial question, do you want to be in the UK or out of the UK, to the Scottish people. He just hopes to run it out and stretch it out for a long time. I know you're a wily politician, George, but you may have met your match in Alex Salmond when it comes to strategy.
Now, tell me this, Torquil. The current standing that you've just described to us of opinion in Scotland will come as a surprise to many and a bit of a sickener, actually, to the rather loud voices that normally dominate this debate, who make you feel as if you're a bit of an oddball if you're someone like me that doesn't actually want the country to break up. Have these figures come as a big surprise in Scotland?
They ought not, because that's broadly where opinion has been for years, if not decades. I mean, the SNP have been arguing for independence since 1930-something. We're now at 2000-and-something, and we're still in the same place. About a third of Scots want independence. Two-thirds of Scots are quite happy to be in Britain. The missing part from that equation is, of course, that nobody is delivering them a vision of what Scotland would be like in Britain. An update, Scotland 2.0 or UK 2.0, an updated version of what the UK should look like. I know you have your ideas and other people have theirs, but we aren't getting a proper image of what Scotland and Britain should look like in the future. So people seem to be not entirely happy with what they've got. They want more power for the Scottish Parliament, but they do want the security of the UK. And with that hurricane coming down the alley from the other side of the continent, starting in Greece, whipping through Italy, Spain, maybe France and Germany too, and probably the UK, because remember, in the middle of this, we are in a double-dip recession, and people's priorities in Glasgow, Gloucester, and every other part of the UK are not about the constitution. They're about their checkbooks and their pay and their jobs. People might find this over 800 days, a campaign for independence, a lot of bluster, but distracting. And you say, why do we seem like oddballs when we say the UK is a good proposition? Because, of course, the media narrative is more exciting if a breakup is on the horizon, if a threat, a bad news story or a danger, a threat is much more exciting to report than business as normal.
Now, you indicated, Torquil, that there's some controversy over how many questions will be in this referendum and who will frame them. Just bearing in mind our international audience, the overwhelming majority of it, just tell us who will decide the question and what is that ballot paper likely to look like on the day?
Very difficult to answer simply, but put it like this. The Scottish Parliament, led by Alex Salmond and the SNP nationalists, want to ask two questions. One, do you want independence? The second question, do you want more power? Devo Max, as you call it. The Westminster Parliament, which has the legal power to hold this referendum, only the Westminster Parliament has the legal power to hold the referendum, wants one simple question, in or out. Now, Westminster is willing to give the power to the Scottish Parliament on condition that Alex Salmond only asks one question. Will Alex Salmond agree to that? Will they get a deal? There's a lot of talking to be done. And if they don't get an agreement, then it goes to the courts. It goes to legal challenge. It goes into a quagmire where Alex Salmond will try and blame the Union Jack Parliament in Westminster for holding him back from his dream of independence. But in fact, we could have that question next Tuesday. He should have held it the Tuesday after he won his massive majority in the Scottish Parliament in Holyrood last year. If he'd done it then, he would have had a better chance than he has now, and possibly a far better chance than he'll have in 800 days when the economic situation could be much, much worse.
Is it possible that they don't actually want it, Torquil? Are they a bit like the Catalan nationalists and nationalist parties in one or two other places? Mm-hmm. They use the card of separatism. They have, of course, a sort of dreamy vision of separatism, but they're actually quite happy, in the case of the Catalans, to remain in the Spanish state with a pretty good deal vis-a-vis Madrid. Is that maybe the game of the Scottish National Party?
I think that may be the game of the Scots, but not the Scottish National Party. The Scottish National Party is still nationalist, still wants separation and independence. The Catalans you describe are what post-nationalist, I suppose. They want a strong state within a state. Perhaps that's where the Hygieians, the high command of the Scottish National Party are as well, but certainly the grassroots and supporters would be driven by and inspired by the idea of breaking away from the United Kingdom, which they see as holding them back in some way. People who are for the United Kingdom, of course, say that Scotland has benefited tremendously from the 300-year political and financial union.
But last question then, Torkel. Is it going to get nasty, as these nationalist issues around the world tend to do?
Well, you've been involved in Scottish politics yourself for a long time. You know what it's like to be involved in that short sword fighting. It will undoubtedly get nasty. It will undoubtedly it'll come in peaks and troughs. I mean, we'll get excited this weekend because of the launch of the Yes to Independence campaign. There'll be a bit of excitement around the Yes to Yes to the UK campaign. It will get nasty, and it'll get nasty in this way, George. I think the way in a couple of years' time, we'll look back, we'll have gone through the long campaign. If we're lucky, we'll get a vote on it. I think now, the way the figures look, Scotland will still be in Britain. But just as after any kind of civil war or family argument, there'll be a lot of bitterness in the room, and Scotland may not be in a bright and happy place. It may be a sad and divided nation because it had to confront this in or out question.
I think you're onto something there, Torkel. I think you're definitely onto something there. As always, deeply grateful to Torkel Crichton of the Scottish Daily Record, a real expert on the developing constitutional issue in Scotland. Will Britain break up? Now, joining me on the line from Washington, D.C. is Lisa Matz. She's Director of Public Policy and Government Relations at the American Association of University Women. Lisa, welcome to The Real Deal. You've just celebrated, if that's the right description, National Women's Health Week in the States, and you've been pointing up the Affordable Care Act, which compels insurance companies to extend preventative health care without extra charges to women and families in several key areas. Would you, Lisa, tell the viewers about the features of this act and whether it's one of the very few pluses that we can chalk up to the first term, at least, of President Obama?
Hi, thanks so much for having me, George. I do think it's one of the pluses we can chalk up for President Obama. Right now, we're actually already feeling some positive effects from the Affordable Care Act. Just ask a young person here in the United States who is still on their parents' health insurance program, even though they're past college age. Right now, under the Affordable Care Act, you can stay up till age 26, which is having a huge impact. And then even more importantly, I think, ask the kid that's got a pre-existing condition, they can no longer, right now, be excluded from health insurance coverage under their family programs. And of course, come this summer, come August, we're going to see even more parts of the Affordable Care Act come into play that people are going to be very happy about. And then after the elections, actually in 2014, we'll see the rest of them come in. So unfortunately, it's a slower process. I wish it could all go into effect at once, but we just haven't been able to make that happen.
How much has changed, Lisa? I watched the other night, again, for the second time, and enjoyed it even more, Michael Moore's film Sicko, which compares and contrasts the United States healthcare system with several others around the world, and unfavorably in every case, even Cuba, perhaps especially Cuba, actually, but Britain even, and France and so on. How much has changed of that picture since President Obama came in?
Well, it certainly has changed for the better, but I still think we have a long way to go. You know, one of the things that we know is happening with the Affordable Care Act is that it is going to have a better, emphasis on prevention services, which is key, not only in terms of being able to deal with the issues, health issues someone has right now, but saving costs down the road. I think if you think about Michael Moore's Sicko documentary, though, we do have a long way to go. I would not compare ourselves to what you all have over there right now, unfortunately. But, you know, it's still a system that is under reform. All of the Affordable Care Act pieces haven't come into play. But I will say, even when they do, we got to remember, it's still not going to be nationalized health care. This is not even necessarily going to be single payer or public option health care. What it does is set up a series of health insurance exchanges around the states who then help people get insurance, provide some subsidies, but it's still very much a private plan-based program. So we still have those for-profit health insurance companies as part of the system. And, you know, I think we can say that whenever you make healthcare something you're supposed to make money off of, you're not necessarily always going to get the exact best services. I will say, though, one very interesting piece of the Affordable Care Act that's coming in that plays right off of that for-profit piece is that right now, the 80-20 rule has come into effect, which basically says that a health insurance company cannot spend less than 80% of its revenues on providing care. So in other words, if you're paying them, they need to be actually using that money for your health care. And if they don't, they have to give you a rebate. So we actually could see some Americans getting a rebate here in the next several months.
It is a kind of parallel universe, though, Lisa, listening to you there. You know, and I hear the right-wing arguments against Obama's reforms on health and so on. And you used the phrase nationalized medicine. The right wing in America talk about socialism, that a national health service equals socialism or even communism for that matter. Is that paradigm beginning to shift at all? Or is this false dichotomy between kind of freedom and the communism of the healthcare system in places like Britain and France still, you know, etched in stone, really?
Oh, I still think it's there. And largely because of our election that's underway, right? I mean, there are a lot of people. In fact, Mitt Romney just said on his third day in office he would repeal Obamacare. So the reality is that's still, I think, a bludgeon they're trying to use against progressives, trying to demonize a program that would give health care to so many more people, still not 100% coverage, but so many more people. And I think the thing that I find most disturbing about it is how short-sighted it is. Because at the end of the day, when you provide basic health care to young people and you do preventive services throughout someone's lifetime, you save money in the end. I mean, if they're really all about money, if they're really all about capitalism and making money, they should want to cover these things, because at the end of the day, there's going to be less Medicare expenditures for seniors. We're going to see a lot less expenditures for even the private health insurance companies. But instead, we're going the other way. When the opponents talk about it, they really want to almost limit services. They say we have the best healthcare country or healthcare services in the world, but you know what? That's only if you have health insurance. And it should be we have the best healthcare services in the world for everybody. We're just not there yet.
Lisa Matz, we'll catch up soon, I hope, and keep abreast of that issue. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, unfortunately. God willing, we'll have more at the same time, in the same place, next week. I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal on Press TV. And you have been a marvellous audience.